Hi, Xian Qi here, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival. You're listening to the Ideas Salon podcast series, recorded live at Byron Writers Festival in 2023. This session, called Misinformation, is a very topical conversation featuring Monica Attard, Anthony Lowenstein, Anke Richter, and Misha Ketchel.
Thank you. I'm just going to introduce the panel in a moment, but first of all, I'd like to say thank you to everybody for coming today. It's lovely to see you all here. I've heard a rumour going around that there's a soccer game on at 5 o'clock today, and we're going to try to finish just a tiny bit early. So for those of you who are committed to seeing that soccer game, you've got a chance, if you run really quickly, to getting somewhere near to seeing the kickoff. I also understand that, you know, Grace Tame is talking right now as well, so the fact that you've chosen this is lovely. So thank you for being here. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on, the Arakwal, Bumbarin and Minjungalbal peoples of the Bunjalung Nation. Sorry, did I mispronounce? Anyone know how to pronounce that? Bunjalung? Is that Bunjalung Nation? Sorry, you've probably heard it all today. And pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on today. So I'm Misha Ketchel. I'm the editor of The Conversation. For any of you that don't know, The Conversation is a media outlet / website that publishes articles written by academic experts to keep people up to date with new research and also to help explain and provide context for issues in the news. If you don't subscribe already, there's a free email newsletter, and it's a terrific source of sort of rigorous, hopefully impartial and reliable evidence-based information. We've got a terrific panel today. We're going to be talking about misinformation and disinformation and what can be done about it. And this is something that I always think about in terms of really how we create a healthy information ecosystem, because we need a healthy information ecosystem to ensure that the decisions that we make, both as individuals and as citizens, are well informed. We have with us today Monica Attard, who is a journalist with more than 30 years' experience, most famously probably as a Russia correspondent, has won many awards in a long career at the ABC, is currently a journalism academic at the Centre for Media Transition at University of Technology, Sydney. Monica is also my old boss, so I will defer to her on all significant questions. We also have Anthony Lowenstein, who is a very well-known journalist who has really for the past sort of at least 20 years been a prominent writer on issues around Israel and Palestine and a range of other significant issues. His latest book is The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. And it's a fascinating book, actually, talking a lot about the ways in which that technology that is developed by Israel is used in different countries. Some of the stories that you'll read in it are actually quite chilling. It's really worth looking at. Anke Richter is our other panellist. Anke is the author of the book Cult Trip, Inside the World of Coercion and Control. And Anke did some terrific reporting looking at cults, really predominantly sort of from the inside in a way, from going right, you know, quite deep, particularly two cults in New Zealand, Centrepoint and Gloria Vale, but also some cults in India. Is it Thailand, the other one? Thailand as well. So that's sort of dealing with misinformation in really, you know, quite specific closed context. So just to kick things off, I'd just like to ask everyone on the panel, and maybe you can all have a shot at this, because I think it's an important question. If you want to have a discussion about misinformation and disinformation, to start talking about what you actually mean by that. I think in public debate, things often get labelled misinformation and disinformation, but we really need to have an understanding of what we're talking about. So perhaps I'll give that to Monica first and then we'll work back. So,
because it's such an easy question, Misha.
Okay.
I think it is a really, really difficult question. I think the basic premise is that misinformation is lawful but awful. And disinformation is awful and illegal. I think that we've got to be very careful that we don't label views that we don't like misinformation, which I think is the tendency these days. Anybody who we disagree with politically, you know, who attempts to express a more nuanced or expresses a nuanced view of something that may just constitute an alternative opinion or an alternate view. Very important that we don't fall into the trap of labelling that misinformation. And I think that has been a bit of a tendency, frankly. The government is now trying to grapple with this question as well. It's come up with a draft bill to try to get the platforms, the social media platforms, so Facebook, Meta, and Google, to do something about the misinformation that, you know, proliferates on those open source kind of platforms. And, you know, it looks like a bit of a blunt instrument in many senses, because it's attempting to define misinformation according to the intention of the person who is creating the information. And, you know, that kind of throws up its own set of problems that the legislation isn't quite grappling with. But anyway, I'm sure we'll get to the legislation in a bit. But in terms of definition, I think it's very much harder these days to define what mis and disinformation is. I think 5-6 years ago, when Donald Trump first burst on the scene, boy, it was really easy to define what misinformation was. Super easy. And since he's disappeared, kind of, from the political spectrum at least, it's become, you know, a far more nuanced experiment to try to define what they are. The difference between them is kind of easy. You know, one's legal, one's not. One's super harmful, where the harms are very, very well defined, and the other one is one where there can be harms, but there aren't always harms. You know, beyond that, I'm not sure where we go.
Okay, Anthony.
Yes, well, I would not disagree with anything Monica said, but I'll add a few points to that. I think one of the key problems that's happened in the last years, and definitely since dear Donald rose, and I'd say he may continue rising for a while, sadly, that to me, when there is a situation where the state tries to define these issues, then I think we have a problem.
Yep.
What I mean by that is that in the last years, there has been this obsession with many in the media, many in governments around the world, that we're bombarded, we're told, by Russian and Chinese disinformation.
Mm.
And I'm not saying there's not truth to that. Obviously, there is disinformation from those two states. But when those conversations happen, they always seem to end there, rather than saying, how about the disinformation or misinformation coming from us, from our side? I mean, one only has to look in the last 20 years since 9/11, the profound levels of dis and misinformation told by government officials, by countless of those in the media for that matter, to cause the death of literally millions and millions of people. And yet apparently we're told that we should be more concerned by Putin convincing Americans to vote for Trump, which was always a lie anyway. So I guess what concerns me is that we are moving towards a situation often pushed by many in the press and too many in government to allow the state to define what that is. I don't think the state has a role in that. I don't think the state should be telling us. Of course, I don't mean that truth doesn't exist. Of course there is truth. Of course there are lies. That's not what I mean. I mean that on so many of the key issues that many of us care about, war, peace, occupation, whatever it may be, our side is the problem. I'm not so concerned about Russia and Chinese disinformation. Sure, if you want to get concerned about it, knock yourself out. But that is not the major concern, in my view, about where our society is. Disinformation coming from our side. In the last 20 years, there was a Brown University study that came out a few months ago, which barely got mentioned at all by any media in the West, which found that 4.5 million people have probably been killed by US-led wars in the last 20 years. Now, we don't hear about that not because of mis or disinformation, because of omission. That, to me, is as much of a problem, if not worse, than mis or disinformation. We're not being told, not because necessarily in a conspiratorial sense, we're just not being heard, you know, hearing about those kinds of pretty key facts. Talking about Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Palestine, numerous conflicts that have consumed those countries, which we just kind of think, well, those wars are over now, we can just move on.
But it can work in the reverse as well, though, Anthony, where they might not necessarily be labelled. You wouldn't label that kind of information misinformation because we're not getting it.
Mm.
Yeah. But the fact that we're not, the absence of it creates this vacuum where it becomes where that just becomes misinformation. So claiming that the United States is responsible for all these things becomes a form of misinformation, and the media just absorb it and spit it out, and it becomes the bottom line of all reporting.
Yes, at times, or they can become, which I think they often are, they being the media handmaidens of the state in pushing that line
exactly.
In the first place. I mean, we've seen that with Iraq and Afghanistan, where journalists were willing propagandists, in my view, towards those conflicts. And I think it's inarguable that if much of the press had not gone along with the lies around Iraq, there would not have been that war.
So, Anthony, how did journalists and why did journalists become willing propagandists? I mean, we all take so much professional pride in trying to find quality information to get to the truth. There's such mythology around it. Everybody that comes into the profession is absolutely passionately committed to it. How does this happen?
I don't think it's just a post 9/11 thing, of course. I mean, obviously, this has been going on for years. I think I've often thought since I started in my career has been post 9/11 that I think most journalists, in my experience, and there's obviously many exceptions, but most journalists want to be close to power. They enjoy that. They enjoy that kind of duchessing of power. And, of course, there are a lot of journalists who don't play that game. But if you want to play a certain game, report on politics in, say, Canberra, London, or Washington, and you want to go to war and you want to hang out with your soldier mates in Iraq or Afghanistan, what you put out publicly has to be a certain perspective. Like if a journalist comes out and says, I want to in bed with the Taliban, which to me would have been a very legitimate thing for journalists to do. It made a lot of sense. And I know a few journalists who did do that, talking about before the Taliban took over again a few years ago. Doesn't mean because you do that, therefore you support the Taliban. It simply means that you believe that they're another side in the war and let's find out what they're saying and what they're doing. Even the concept of that is totally foreign to the vast majority of foreign correspondents about Iraq and Afghanistan. They wouldn't even consider it. It's just like, what a crazy idea. Well, embed with American troops or Australian troops or British troops, and there's a role for that. But it's so narrow what we're getting. And the impact of being a propagandist for the state is that I think people's distrust of the media and government is directly linked to that. In so many of these cases, what we were told were lies. And a lot of journalists, I would argue, either knew that or were willing to accept things that they thought were probably not true.
And social media accelerates.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because on social media, you're either with the goodies or you're with the baddies. And if you put
it's binary.
Yeah. And if you put an alternative view, you're with the baddies, and then you will get piled on, or you will get cancelled. Mm. You know, it's not just in look at the coverage of the Russia-Ukraine war. I mean, has anybody in this room, in this space, heard any account of why Russia mounted its war beyond the often argued point that they claim that Ukraine is full of Nazis, which, you know, has kind of died off as a bit of an argument. But it was the only argument for a long time. So, you know, we journalism just takes this incredibly narrow view, which happens to align with a view expressed in Washington. And then that is what's reinforced on social media, and it's given strength and it's pushed, and the people who are perpetrating it are rewarded. They're rewarded with more followers and more clicks on their stories.
And they fail up. I mean, we talked about
this.
We can talk about this later, but there are so many key journalists and editors in the last 20 years who got literally everything wrong and their career has gone much better since. What does that tell you? I'm happy to name the people. It's not a secret. I mean, there's so many of them. Their careers have failed up.
Yeah.
Despite getting everything wrong.
I want to come back to that.
Yes.
First of all, Anka, did you have thoughts on this?
Kia ora. I'm a foreign correspondent too, but I've never been embedded with the Taliban, but I've been embedded with the alternative scene for a long time. And I don't know if you know that I've also become an activist in the pandemic and started a group in New Zealand called FACT, which stands for Fight Against Conspiracy Theories. So my focus is less on the disinformation. I mean, the disinformation has absolutely crept into those spaces too, but the misinformation, which I see more as people unwittingly spreading mis and disinformation. And to see the roll-on effects of that and the devastating effects on that on our indigenous population in New Zealand, on so many people who used to be maybe lefty greenies, who were progressives, who are now turned homophobic, transphobic, anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, you name it, that's all my focus. That's my battlefield, so to speak, where I feel quite passionate because I also have skin in the game because I move in the alternative festival world and I came into this sort of activism, which you normally don't do as a journalist. You're always on the outside, but it became really personal because a very popular spiritual alternative music festival in New Zealand was promoting David Icke, Holocaust denier David Icke, on their website and a few others, but he would be the most prominent name. And from that sort of, out of sheer desperation, you know, we started a group in New Zealand called Rabbit Hole Resistance as a Facebook group, and actually lots of people from this area are in there as well. And I'm speaking about this because I think especially here for the Northern Rivers and, you know, the Byron Shire and a lot of places where you have a lot of alternative culture, which I truly love and embrace, and I also see the effect of misinformation and the division it's caused. And it's not just about anymore about whether, you know, someone gets vaccinated or not. I think we're past that, right? It's what is next? What's the next level of dis and misinformation coming in, and how is it undermining democracy? How is it undermining human safety? And I don't mean just on a medical level, yeah. And the Disinformation Project in New Zealand, academic research program, they just released some data that how much more transphobia has increased in those spaces. And as you probably know, I mean, New Zealand's done a fantastic job in keeping the pandemic out, and all, you know, power to Jacinda Ardern, but we didn't keep the infodemic out. That's come in, and for me it's kind of heartbreaking to see how places, friends, events, festivals, the wellness scene, how that's turned into a cesspit of highly problematic, anti-democratic, anti-human sometimes views. And sorry if I'm going on a bit of a rant here, but I think this is also, I'm totally in awe of what you know about politics, because I don't. I'm like, oh, these are the big shots, yeah. But I'm kind of the expert in that field of, you know, that, and it also matters because it's not just a niche thing, especially not here in this area. And in general, the whole wellness industry, it's become mainstream. Everyone goes to yoga class or has done, listen to meditation, or, you know, drinks their smoothies. This is not just the cults that I write about. Yeah, there's an overlap, of course, but it's, I'm really, really concerned how these spaces that actually stand for something positive and regenerative and sustainable, how they've become such a, I'm on a rant, sorry, but it is personal.
It's actually a really interesting question that you're raising, though, because you're talking about your concern about some of these ideas, say, for example, being propagated by people who are, say, anti-vaxxers, for example, who I know as an editor would often argue that the media has actually failed to publish a full spectrum of opinions on some of these topics, and that actually journalists should have investigated more contrary theories or contrary perspectives. Now, Anthony was just talking about the idea that it's impossible politically to expect a journalist to be embedded with the Taliban.
Yeah.
So he's basically saying that the idea of what is acceptable is too narrow. And that actually is defining out of our thinking things that we should be thinking about. And you're saying that actually some ideas are being propagated that are problematic. So you can see it's hard to draw these
lines.
It
is hard. Okay, here's my take on it. And I can't speak for the Australian media because I don't follow that enough, sorry. But, you know, New Zealand, similar patterns, I would say. First of all, I think that the New Zealand media, and maybe it's true for most media outlets around the Western world, they've realized way too late how big this conspirituality problem is, because there's a sort of inbuilt bias or arrogance or cynicism, which I totally get, you know, but it doesn't help, against anything esoteric and alternative. So that doesn't get covered by the media. We get, you know, sports covered and real estate and movies, and everything has its section in the newspapers ever since the beginning of newspapers, but we don't have sections that cover the new age. And I think that's really bad, because it's a business, it's an unregulated market. So a lot of the stuff that I saw early on in the pandemic, because of my cult journalism, my personal connections and groups I've moved through, I saw a lot of these things springing up around the world. I thought, oh my God, what is happening with those people who I once thought that they have something good to say? So, and it took forever until my colleagues, and jumped on that. Now, realized there's a problem, and then every reporter and their dog wanted to do a story about an anti-vaxxer. Oh, I do, and then they always came to me because I was the media liaison for this group Fact, and like, oh, can you bring us someone who's not, you know, who's been down the rabbit hole and up, and now it's fine. And it's not as simple as that. But to come to your question, how it's been covered, I can only speak for some, you know, from what I've watched in New Zealand media. I think they went to great lengths to also give the people, the protesters at Parliament in Wellington. I don't know if you follow this. We had the, you know, similar to the truckers convoy in Canada. We had our Kiwi version of that, and it went on for a long time, and it was a big issue. And I think the New Zealand media went to quite some lengths to also let people speak from there, not just paint them as crazies and give some of their maybe invalid concerns, you know, a voice. But it is tricky. I know what you mean, and I don't think we always get it right. Yeah, and then at the same time, you also know, you know, everyone knows this saying, you know, if person A says it's raining outside and person B says it's not, your job as a journalist is not to equally let, you know, report on both sides, but go outside and check the weather. So
okay,
we're often expected to give both sides the same weight, and you can't do this when there is clear misinformation. I don't think that's the way to go about it.
So let's go to the question of how we actually create a better media ecosystem, like what we do to actually improve and deal with this problem of misinformation. So Monica, I just want to go to you for a sec. So if you're sort of in charge of the government policy, the way we're regulating misinformation, the media, what things would you like to see change to improve the way that we cover a whole range of issues?
Look, I think it has to happen at a couple of different levels. I mean, I think the prospect of having government have any role in the determination of what is fact and what is not fact is massively problematic. Mm-hmm. We're kind of halfway there and we don't want to be there, so we need to stop travelling down that road. And as I mentioned earlier, the new bill that is giving the Australian Communications Media Authority extra powers to control mis and disinformation, you know, I'm not as hysterically worried about it as News Corp is, because that's very self-serving worrying that's happening there. But they do
have business model is hysteria.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, but they do have a kind of a little point that they're trying to make, which is not an invalid point, that what the bill does is give ACMA the ability to say to a platform, you know, we've received a complaint that this has appeared on your website, therefore you should investigate. So that is kind of, that is de facto determining what is mis and disinformation, and I think that's really dangerous. So I kind of prefer models like the European models, and certainly the United Nations has just come up with a new paper which is called Information Integrity on Digital Platforms, and it's kind of moving away from defining mis and disinformation and moving more towards models of looking at what information integrity looks like. That is to say, when you look at the information ecosystem as a whole, how much integrity does it contain and how do you increase it? And they've kind of, the way what they've come up with is that there's a couple of things I was just writing about that need to be considered. That, like the Europeans, you create a system where you've got the digital platforms, the media, community groups and fact checkers are working together, as opposed to working, you know, independently in silos. That you increase the use of fact checkers, which I think is problematic. We kind of got to discussing this, Misha, before we came here, but, you know.
Maybe could you just share that with the audience, though, because I think it's a really interesting point. I mean, my personal view is that fact-checking doesn't work. It's an argument that the digital platforms use to justify taking no responsibility for the accuracy of their information in the first place. Mm. And their idea is that you can publish whatever you want, and then a fact-checker comes along and says this is wrong, and the antidote actually undoes the damage that was originally done. And we know from all sorts of studies that is actually not true. You need to have a healthy information ecosystem in the first place.
Exactly.
So I think that's a really difficult... It's really interesting. Sorry, just a little tangent and I'll come back to you. But when I was working for you many years ago in the Media Watch salt mines, I remember I was...
He's really exaggerating,
yes,
by the way.
One of the things that I had to do...
It was the gulag, actually. Yeah. It wasn't the salt mine. It's even worse, but yeah.
One of the things that I had to do was read a lot of websites that were written sort of by people who had various agendas, and it was sort of gossip and it was misinformation and it was pretty dodgy, because I'd be looking for little sources of information that I could check out that might be true. And I remember I always used to tell myself, oh, if I read it in that site, I know it's unreliable, and I have to actually sort of quarantine that in my mind because it's separate information. And routinely I'd find myself going to parties or being on the phone or being in editorial conferences or whatever and saying, oh, I read somewhere this thing, and then I'd go, oh, actually, that was from that source.
Right.
And I realised I was absolutely incapable of quarantining poor information in my mind. Yep. And I think that's really telling, because we all tell ourselves, we all think we're sophisticated, we all think we can resist advertising, we all think we can resist misinformation, we all think we know it when we see it. But if you're being routinely exposed to it, it gets in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's part, you know, part of that is the problem of there being so, as you say, so much information that we're inundated with it. But, you know, I don't think fact checkers, I totally agree, fact checking is not the only answer, but a coalition, a broad coalition of stakeholders, including fact checkers, might begin to help. I mean, the United Nations also talks about algorithmic transparency from the platforms. In other words, the platforms telling people what they're doing, how they're tweaking the algorithms to make, you know, this particular view, which is known to be incorrect, giving that more prominence or not. And deprioritizing user engagement, which is never going to happen, because that's what the platform's business model is built on. Yeah. It's never going to happen. So it is it's a devil of a problem, isn't it? It's a wicked problem.
I'm just going to say briefly, I mean, one of the things also that strikes me in a more practical sense is that, you know, when you spend a lot of time, I spent a lot of time in the last 20 years, as you said, reporting on, say, in Palestine or Afghanistan or elsewhere, is that so much of the narrative which we're given by much of the mainstream press and, frankly, much of the political class on those two conflicts, but many others too, is either wrong or incredibly narrow. So a lot of people, when the Taliban took over Afghanistan 2 years ago, were sort of shocked. How did this happen? Well, if you spend a bit of time, as most journalists did not, outside the Kabul bubble and spoke to a lot of Afghans, the vast majority of whom do not live in big cities, not everyone is embracing the Taliban, they're not, but they're profoundly disillusioned with the corrupt US-backed government. That's the seeds of destruction. And yet, so much of the Western media coverage was almost, yes, it acknowledged that the Kabul government was corrupt, but the Taliban's, you know, surely are far, far worse. And you can argue whether they are or they're not. But the problem is, if too many journalists spend too much of their time speaking to the same people in the same places, they're going to get the same results. And that to me is contributing to misinformation, because they're sending out a certain message about reporting which is not true. And Palestine is exactly the same problem.
It sounds like the story you're telling is one of media failure. We actually need to do our jobs better.
A lot better. And on Palestine, I mean, without wishing to talk about my last 20 years of my career, but I mean, the short answer is, for so much of the last, frankly, 75 years since Israel's birth, so much of the media coverage about this issue, not all of it, there's some good journalists obviously doing good work, like on every issue, but so much of it is simply either untrue or holding on to some romantic notion about the glories of Israeli democracy, ignoring the elephant in the room, which is the fact that Israel is occupying Palestinians for over half a century and brutalizing them day to day, and somehow wondering why, as time goes on, which is what's happening now, as Israel is moving towards quasi-theocracy, more and more people in publics around the world are changing their views. That's what public opinion is saying. Here, US, UK is recognizing that, sorry, why are we supposed to be supporting Israel when it's basically a quasi-fascist government literally oppressing Palestinians? And many people, it's this disconnect between what we've often been told by our governments, who regularly say, you know, it's shared values with Israel and it's a glorious democracy. It's all bullshit. And the facts on the ground just don't reflect that at all.
No, same with...
It's a conundrum, isn't it? Because, I mean, I think it's great that we can be self-critical here, and we're in this journalist bubble and looking at how can we do this better. At the same time, if someone hears you now, I mean, someone who is deeply entrenched in conspiracy theories thinks that we're all shills anyway and the media is just lying, and I mean, of course, they're going to hear what you're saying and you're basically confirming their view. So how to find that balance to do better, but in the end, as imperfect as the mainstream media is, it's still the best that we've got, I would say, at this stage, given the alternatives and the alternative platforms. And I also want to make a bit of a, not be an advocate for the, definitely not an advocate for the believer in misinformation, but just raise some compassion also and to help us understand better also, why do people distrust us in the first place? And why do they distrust the system? And what is sort of systemic in their distrust? And whether, you know, that could be racism, yeah? If you've come up against a health system that also always treats you like second class, or you're a woman who's declared hysterical because she has certain concerns, and you know, if you're, there are so many layers of why people have justified not just skepticism, and then also a lot of them think they're doing what we're doing, they're questioning everything, they're doing their research, yeah, and we laugh at them and we mock them, and they're the ones down, you know, they're down the rabbit hole and all of that, but in some ways they're trying to apply the same principles of not just trusting the propaganda they're told. Do you see where I'm coming from? It is a bit of a conundrum.
I do.
So, but just not just shut that down.
But journalism's job is not, is journalism's job is to report in the public interest. It's not to advocate for any particular viewpoint or any particular side.
Yeah.
And you know, what you're talking about kind of feels to me to be getting closer to advocacy. And I have a real aversion to advocacy journalism because I just see the damage that it has done. The issue that Anthony is concerned with, the one that I'm concerned with any number of issues in the news cycle at the moment, I think advocacy journalism has kind of grown tentacles. And it's everywhere. It's almost considered the most legitimate form, legitimate genre of journalism at the moment.
Okay, I'm a proud card-carrying advocacy journalist because with my card journalism. Huh? Yeah. I give people a voice who haven't had that voice before. I speak to activists. I mean, I also make sure everything's factually correct. Those groups that I report on, these groups, they have their own channels. They have their websites and their PR and their you know, all their promotional material. They don't need to have the same speaker, you know, the same space in my book, for instance. But of course, I'm advocating. And I think also if you're a war journalist, you're also advocating, you know, for the people who are not in power, who don't have a voice. I think that's really important.
I think we might be at cross purposes. I think there's nothing wrong with advocating for the truth. I think that's the role of journalism.
Exactly.
Yeah. But advocacy journalism doesn't always advocate for the truth. It advocates for a side. It employs a kind of a way of doing journalism that starts off with one hypothesis and then moves to gather information that can support that single hypothesis rather than looking at an issue and saying, you know, what is a provable fact here and what can be discarded, and then what goes into a final analysis that can then be verified. I mean, that's the public interest methodology of journalism, and I don't think advocacy journalism does that. In fact, I know it doesn't do that. But I think it's okay to advocate for a truth. That's a different thing. That's a completely, that's outside the methodology of journalism, if you know what I'm saying.
Do you think, Monica, there are forces that are making journalism that doesn't adopt that advocacy model harder to pursue?
Yeah, heaps. I mean, as I said before, I mean, our social media, for starters, I mean, social media rewards advocacy journalism because it gives you more clicks. You're saying what people... Advocacy journalism is really well suited to issues where there's a righteous cause involved. And so that wins lots of followers and likes, and, you know, the journalist becomes a kind of quasi-celebrity, and, you get all of the good stuff when you do it. But if you buck the trend, you say what Anthony says on social media, or what I say in relation to, you know, in relation to the Russia-Ukraine war, you'll be black banned. You will be rolled. You'll be piled on. You'll be thrown out and ignored.
So, do you think? I mean, I've always felt that, like, you know, growing up reading newspapers, for example, I was used to reading views that I actively disagreed with, and that was part of what I wanted in my media consumption. Do you think that people consuming the media now, and this is a question for the whole panel, are being trained to want to read things with which they are more likely to agree?
Do you know, a lot of young journalists often contact me, either studying journalism or just want to get into the profession. And what I often say, which is what I do myself, is that I said you should spend, in my view, the majority of your time, whatever media you're consuming, whether it's online, print, whatever you do, at least half should be stuff you fundamentally disagree with. That's what I do. So I spend a lot of time watching Fox, lucky me, and other very right-wing media, not because I agree with Fox, but a lot of issues I write about or right-wing media on, whether it's to do the war on terror or Afghanistan or disaster capitalism or Palestine, I want to know what a lot of people are saying who don't agree with me, don't agree with that position, and that does involve having to consume a lot of stuff that I don't necessarily enjoy. But I think unless you understand and consume, in my view, that kind of media, if we simply consume media that confirms what we believe, then it seems to me almost beside the point. That's what I would say.
But ideally, a proper newspaper media outlet would always do that in itself.
But
you would have the different,
right?
You know, you have the different opinion pieces. You know, one day you have that voice, the conservative voice on the issue, the next day the other side gets to say something. So ideally, doesn't always happen, but that's where you'd get it from. But the fact is, like, how many people still read a proper newspaper, right?
Yeah.
And even the newspapers, yes, thank you, right? Yeah, I'm old school too. I'm a subscriber to magazines and newspapers, and I love it. But even when you go online, for instance, Stuff, our biggest media news website, news platform, I'm sorry, in New Zealand, has its various newspapers. If you read them, you get quite a different diet of articles, like more quality than when you go online and see what they, you know, what is more the clickbaity stuff. You get a very different selection of what you would be reading at first, unless you're specifically looking for something. So again, it's also how do we consume media? What do we go for? How is it being financed? It's so complex. It also comes then down to who pays for it and advertising and all these things, and what you talked about before, Monica, with algorithms. And I mean, to be honest, I don't even know if it's a battle we can still win. I think we're trying our best and doing it from in our various corners with the tools and the integrity we have. But I'm actually quite worried, to be honest.
Well, interestingly, the latest Reuters Digital News report said that of the under 25s, an increasingly large proportion are getting all of their information from social media. They're not getting it from newspapers. They're not getting it from TV. They're not getting it from radio. And that information is selected by the algorithms to provoke certain types of responses. So, you know, I think one of the things that I worry about is people getting out of the habit of reading stuff with which they disagree. So, for example, at The Conversation, we try to run a range of academic views on every topic. And as a reader, I actively seek out, as like Anthony, I think that's absolutely right, I try to seek out stuff I disagree with as much as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. But increasingly, I'm finding a lot of media outlets, what they've got is very monotone. There will not be countering views within the media outlets because the audiences, I think, often won't tolerate it. Yeah. I mean, if we publish pieces that are challenging people's preconceived views on a range of issues, you'll often hear about that, and the audiences are very demanding of a particular view.
Do you think it's because of intersectionalism as well, that you're easily then labelled something? If you've said this, you're a TERF, or if you've said that, you're the racist, or is there too much? I'm just asking you got, as the experts as well.
Look,
is there a fear of being put into a corner that
just a business model? I mean,
the
business models
discussion.
That, you know, you've got the Australian, you've got News Corp papers at one end, and their business model is dependent on, you know, their particular constituency and the way they think, and their delight and pleasure and agreement with kinds of arguments that they mount. And at the other end, you've got Guardian Australia, kind of the mirror image. They're exactly the same. I mean, they're both playing advocacy journalism, just at different ends of the political spectrum. Mm. And you know, what's in the middle? Well, I mean, the ABC purports to be in the middle. The ABC tries to be in the middle. Sometimes it manages that and sometimes it doesn't. But, it tries to kind of steer that pathway down the middle.
It seems to me, even since I started, I guess, being a journalist in the last 20 years, it's regularly struck me, and it's not unique to Australia, it happens in many countries, that so many media outlets seemingly are trying so hard to be vanilla. and being so beige. In other words, they want to be, almost seems like they want to be as dull as possible. I mean, that might seem like a weird business model because obviously you want to try to get readers or viewers, you'd think, but I find that more and more, not that, you know, there aren't outlets that do some boring stuff or some good stuff. One, it's hard, you know, I don't want to generalize, but I do find more and more to me that there's a lot of outlets that seem to, I find in a way, maybe don't want to upset anybody about anything and therefore just become kind of vanilla. And you think, well, why do you exist then? Like, why do you exist?
Yeah.
If you're not, I mean, obviously, yes, there's a view about saying you could be too far right, too far left. You know, what's the, I'm not saying the solution, by the way, is to be a boring as hell centrist. That also sounds just like death warmed up. So I'm not suggesting that either. But I think there is something that a lot of newspapers, media outlets don't want to run things that I would argue seem to challenge their readers' biases, which is ties into what you said.
Okay. I mean, you're probably talking from your field, so I'm sure you have, you know, you have your reasons where you've seen that, that certain things don't get into the media that should. I also think from sort of my corner, it often just also comes down to resources and newsrooms being understaffed, sure, and overworked. And if there's a really hot, you know, what I think is a hot topic and someone should go there, I mean, I can't do all this, you know, it's a big investigation. I don't have the means. I'm a freelance journalist. I've been burned by some of the stuff I've done, but I've always happily passed things on. And I'm often so frustrated that I think, but they could do that and they don't. And it often comes down to, oh, it's going to take someone so many weeks and so much legalizing, and then there are other more pressing news stories, and then it, you know, that's often how it goes. There isn't always an agenda. Often it's just the economics of...
So to sum up and try to get towards some solutions. So,
yeah,
Monica, you said basically you've got some concerns about the government regulating misinformation.
Oh, yeah, I do. But also, yeah. But I think the big, for me, the big solution, Misha, is better journalism.
Better journalism, that's right. Yeah. And I think, you know, Anthony would be very strongly agreeing on that from what I've heard so far. Yes. But the question is how? Like, what do we do? Because we're saying that the media is somewhat too partisan. It's not running enough counterviews, but some of the counterviews it's running, maybe it shouldn't be running because they include misinformation or they're problematic. So how do we... What do we do to create a healthier information ecosystem? Because to me, I think the major problem is actually you need good actors, you need good faith actors in the ecosystem who are motivated only by one thing, and that's informing the public. And they're not necessarily doing advocacy. And to do that, you have to train people and you have to pay them.
Yeah.
And there's no real business model for that. It's very difficult now to actually create a journalism business based on that. If you look at BuzzFeed and Vice, for example, which were digital media companies that started up sort of in the, you know, 2000s, which are now closed, been unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. New digital media brands really struggle to do work. It's mostly the old digital media brands like the New York Times, the Guardian, that have survived and thrived. And they do a lot of terrific journalism, but so much of our media ecosystem now is produced by user-generated content, which is somewhat unreliable, or by models of journalism that are very much based on expression of opinions.
Yeah.
Where do we get these people who are doing the sort of work, Anthony, that you're doing, where you're actually trying to expose yourself to counter views? That's the hard work, right?
It is obviously hard. I mean, I would love to see a lot more philanthropically based journalism, which does happen much more in the US. The US is basically is a shit show these days for 1,000 reasons. However, even though it's a much larger country, there is a much more diverse media there. There still is. On a range of issues. Oh, of course, Australia is a smaller market. I understand that. But the idea of not having, say, far more philanthropic-backed media here, I think, is a problem. It does exist, but it's very small. A lot of rich people who could afford it. Anyone listening, I'm available. but I think that model is not really been explored much in Australia. I know there have been some attempts. Some were successful, some were not. I know some of that history, of course, in the last two decades. But I think that is... an idea, and also I think, in my view, not that I think we need to have more government-backed media, but more government funding, which is happening in parts of Europe to support more independent-type press. That is happening in parts of Europe, and in some places it is working.
Do you think the government-funded model brings with it its own problems, though?
Of course.
Mm. Yeah.
But every model does.
Yeah. Anka, did you have thoughts on that?
I don't have any idea about business models or how to, you know, save us from those problems. But in general, I think we just need to maybe as journalists be a bit more aware of the psychology and the susceptibility of people who fall into disinformation in the first place, and not shame and mock them. But and just, while we also shouldn't be naive about, let's say, far-right extremism that creeps into those spaces and has nice-looking front organizations like Voices for Freedom in New Zealand. They're all like knitting mums just concerned about your body. And that's so it's this interplay between let's not be naive and understand how some of these, you know, politics, really destructive, anti-democratic, let's just say fascist politics, are creeping into those spaces. At the same time, understanding why they land with people and taking their concerns of the people who are susceptible, taking their concerns and their living situations and those demographics seriously.
I'm really interested in this idea of not shaming or mocking people who fall into mistaken beliefs or beliefs that you disagree with, because I think that sort of art of knowing how to disagree and how to disagree respectfully is actually a really important part of creating a healthier media ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, it's the, you know, the, there are experts on this, how to talk to people who fall into conspiracy theories, and you're not going to win anyone over with facts because they're in there for emotional reasons, and so you can save all your time and energy to mock and shame them on social media. It's not going to help. It's going to entrench them further. The only way is really if you're personally invested on a one-on-one basis, and it's the same. I mean, I could talk about cows until the cows come home because that's my topic, but there's this overlap of the same with people who've fallen into cults, that you're not going to get them out that way by telling them what they believe in is bad. You have to actually sort of follow them a step of the way into what they believe and understand and have compassion for that, and then you can maybe reach them on an emotional level, and that's only going to happen in relationships or people who are actually important to you. And it's hard work. I'm not good at it. I'm better at starting activist groups and talking about it in panels, but on a one-on-one basis, I find it really hard and frustrating. So lots of kudos and respect to people who have that compassion and have the patience and can do that.
Okay. We're getting to the point where we're needing to wrap up. Monica, did you have any thoughts on anything else that we should be thinking about that can actually help us create a healthy media ecosystem?
Well, I think once the, there is some adequate mechanism to not control the kinds of the kind of information that appears on social media, but to ensure that there's kind of informational integrity that appears on the digital platforms, that's going to help. I don't quite know what that mechanism is in Australia yet. It probably is a combination of what the Americans are intending to do and what the Europeans are already doing. So maybe some kind of hybrid in there, but I'm fairly certain that the current ACMA bill is probably not it. You know, once we've got that in place, then I think the next major area, which is the one that you kind of touched on, Anthony, which is where, you know, you're getting young people coming through who need to be exposed to a variety of different views and opinions. And like you say to young people around you, I certainly say to the students in their hundreds who come across my path that, you know, in your first semester at university, you should be aiming to follow 500 people on Twitter, which is now X. I was going to say Z, but I got caught out in that earlier. X, and they should be, you know, half of those people should be people in organisations with whom you agree, and half should be people in organisations with whom you disagree. And they kind of, their eyes roll to the back of their heads, but they kind of do it. But I think, you know, the kids who are coming into journalism now have had 10 years where their information consumption has been dominated by opinion.
Mm.
And that's what they think is reasonable and valid and factual, which is really frightening. So it's getting that out of them as well, which is part. But I think for me the biggest thing is for informational integrity is if journalism just does a bit of a better job. Sorry, Anka, drop the advocacy journalism, go for public interest journalism, go for fact, verifiable fact, have it come from a diversity of sources so that people get a fuller view of what the real move, you know, the forces are that are shaping our world.
And also the idea of, yes, and I agree. And I mean, to me, there's no real reason why there shouldn't be also media literacy and those types of courses starting at school when kids are incredibly young. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen. I mean, why wouldn't that start in kindergarten? Yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying they're going to become investigative journalists at six. I get that's not an ideal age. But there's no reason whatsoever why there can't be all these kinds of questions. No, the fact that a kid does that for 12 years doesn't guarantee they're going to end up, you know, in the way that everyone here likes. I get that too. But at the moment, that doesn't happen really much at all. And that, I think, is a real problem.
Okay. Anka, your final thoughts on what we should do to fix the world of journalism?
Oh, well, it's going so well, isn't it? I mean, well, yeah. I mean, look, I guess, anyway, I mean, I've been, I guess, an independent journalist for 20 years, and obviously I'm not doing it to make my millions, clearly. But I think I mean, I've often, I guess, chosen to write about issues, whether it's Palestine or disaster capitalism or the drug war, issues that I think often I want to challenge a certain point of view or general worldview that I see pushed by much in the press.
Anthony, just quickly, because you just said independent journalist, and it made me think about your career and the work you've done. Your choice not to do it in another, you know, journalistic setting, like in a big journalistic organisation. Do you think you could have done your work in a big journalistic organisation?
Probably not.
No way, Anthony. Could you possibly?
No.
So, for example, the things you've written about Israel and Palestine, you couldn't have written them at the ABC or the Sydney Morning Herald.
I don't want to say those papers or outlets never publish anything good on that issue. They do, but I think it would have been. Well, there would have been a lot of pressure, particularly on that issue, amongst others.
But that tells you about a problem, doesn't it? Yep. About this idea of the media's breadth, capacity to look at issues from a range of perspectives.
Yes.
If that's not possible, then that's indicative of a problem, possibly.
But as much as we're bashing them, I think also I want to, that's my final word here, please pay for good journalism. You know, subscribe. Don't complain about paywalls, right? They're there for a reason. So please put your money where your mouth is, or what you said. Even that might, you know, speak against what you said about creating more of an echo chamber. But it's the best we have is actually paid reporters who are taking their job seriously, even if they're not always getting it right.
They're doing good public
and their boss is not always getting it right. But it's a super important profession, and I think we need it more than ever in this world. So please support it.
Fantastic. Well, look, thank you so much. I'd like to thank our panelists. Absolutely terrific. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you for being such a lovely audience. Go Matildas. So everybody who wants to watch the game, now's your chance. Bye-bye. Thank you.
You can bring out the tomato juice.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.